From KCRW, I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Shonda wrote a really persuasive note to ABC saying, listen, you air actual rape. You air the actual violence. You don't have a problem with the violence. This is the medicine, and we need to be able to show it in full. So respectfully, we decline this note.
When Grey's Anatomy showrunner Krista Vernoff submitted a script this season that included a more than 2 minute long uninterrupted scene of a patient undergoing a rape kit exam, ABC's Standards and Practices Department wanted some changes. The show's creator stepped in and pushed back. Vernoff and Elizabeth Finch, the writer of that episode, recently sat down to talk about what happened with Leslie Goldberg of The Hollywood Reporter. They discuss how they ultimately got their powerful episode about sexual consent to air as written and provide a peek at their process for breaking new ground on Grey's Anatomy, which recently overtook ER as the longest-running medical drama in primetime TV history. But first on the news banter, comedies in crisis. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for Kim Masters, and I'm joined by my partner in banter this week, Brooks Barnes of the New York Times. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Matt.
So this summer, we've seen an interesting phenomenon at the box office. Comedies are just failing. And it happened recently with the Mindy Kaling comedy Late Night, which got a lot of buzz out of Sundance and sold for $13 million. And its first weekend of wide release made about $5 million. Not good for Amazon, which was releasing it. And it's just one after another. Palms, which was a older female-skewing comedy. And The Hustle with Anne Hathaway. And Long Shot with Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. One after another, these movies aren't working. And then the question becomes, why?
There are a couple things. One is that streaming, Netflix, Amazon itself, has trained people to expect easy entertainment. It points out the expense and hassle of going to a theater. And the other thing is sort of the nature of these specific movies, like Mindy Kaling, enormous television star, enormously talented actress and writer, not a movie star. She's not shown an ability to bring people into theaters.
But who is a movie star these days? I would have thought Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen, two proven hit makers, would draw people to Long Shot, which got very good reviews out of South by Southwest. You know, Anne Hathaway, is she not a star in a comedy? It seems like something larger in the business is going on here. And I do think that it's the Netflixification of a genre. The fact that people now think that there's enough comedy on Netflix that they don't have to go out to see it in a theater. And they're increasingly willing to go to theaters only for the pre-branded franchises, action adventure, Disney remakes, and the stuff that screams, gotta see it in the theater.
Yeah, and at the same time, that stuff in theaters, there's this sort of merging of genres. Like, what is Aladdin if not a comedy for a certain crowd? And all of the humor in the Marvel movies. To some degree, that has kind of taken over the need for people to laugh together in a theater.
That's true. And I don't think the studios are blameless here, because if people say, oh, people just aren't showing up for the movies, well, the studios aren't making those kinds of movies for the most part. They see it as risky in that no man's land of a mid-budget movie that isn't an indie that costs nothing or a pre-branded tentpole. And the humor element and even the stars sometimes aren't considered international enough. The humor doesn't travel. And you see that even with films that are breakout comedies in the U.S., something like Girls Trip, or even this past January with The Upside, the Kevin Hart, Bryan Cranston movie that did very well in the U.S., over $100 million, zero overseas. So the studios see these as riskier. The comedies that do get made tend to go to these studios like STX and MGM, which are kind of more willing to take risks on stars and mid-budget movies. And consequently, the audience, I believe, is shifting to Netflix for these kinds of things.
I think that's true, but I also think that there's this a special way of releasing some of these movies. Booksmart was an example, Late Night, in terms of going a little bit to do word of mouth and then super wide. That is not an easy business. It's kind of like starting a campfire by rubbing two sticks together. Oh, I can do that. Well, have you ever tried it? It's really, really hard.
Right.
And when you look at Amazon's track record as a sole distributor, not partnering with anyone else, literally every one of their movies is a disaster. I guess you could pull out Cold War, the foreign film, at $4.5 million, but everything else has not worked. So you have to start wondering, do they know what they're doing?
Right. And one outlet that seems to know what they're doing in this genre is Netflix, because they did have a movie star in a big movie comedy that same weekend that Late Night opened. They had Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. And we always take Netflix audience boasts with a grain of salt because they are not verified. But Netflix claims that 30 million people at least accessed that film on its quote-unquote opening weekend. And those are 30 million people that potentially might have considered going to see Late Night.
Comedy is also one of those things that you kind of don't know. You're taking a risk more so than with another movie, I think. Am I going to think this is funny? So, you know, sure, I'll check out whatever Netflix is serving up new on Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. Well, I think it's funny. Maybe I'll go in the other room for a while and give them one of those views. I don't know.
Yeah, it is. And Netflix has had a lot of success with the rom-com genre, with these teen-oriented films like To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is something that the studios aren't making as much, although Warner Brothers had success last summer with Crazy Rich Asians. But, you know, speaking of Warner Brothers, I want to shift for a moment to a major deal that happened this past week. It's not quite done as we're taping, but Warner Brothers and Warner Media, the parent company, really stepped up and signed J.J. Abrams and his Bad Robot company he runs with his wife, Katie. They are inking what we are told is a deal in the $500 million range for all content, film, television, digital, everything Bad Robot makes over the next few years will be a Warner Media entity. And that's a potential game changer for Warner Media in a number of different ways.
Mm-hmm. Music, video games. They want great content for their streaming service, just like Disney, just like Comcast is going to be following. And Bad Robot, it's hard to find a more reliable or blue chip production company. You know, they've had hits and misses, yes, but that's part of the business. And the other thing that I thought was interesting about that deal is that John Stankey closed it. And that was supposed to be sort of the wrap, that if you bring an outsider from telecom world into Hollywood, those are the kind of deals Warner won't get. I don't know. I just kind of liked that they pulled it away from all the other moguls, which were chasing too.
Right. John Stankey being the CEO of Warner Media and comes from the AT&T business, and he's somewhat of a neophyte in Hollywood, and now he's got a big bragging right over J.J. Abrams. And of course, a quirk of this deal is that Kevin Sugihara, who was the CEO of Warner Brothers during this negotiation, was let go in the middle due to a scandal involving him trying to solicit jobs on behalf of a woman that he was having an extramarital affair with. And one of the biggest vocal advocates for Warner Media doing something about this was Katie McGrath, J.J. Abrams' wife. So the fact that Stankey was able to clean up the Sugihara situation and then still go after J.J. Abrams and get that deal done is something. If you're going after a hitmaker, you could do a lot worse than someone who's directed Star Wars movies and created shows like Westworld and Felicity and Lost. You know, he really will be a game changer, I think.
But at what point is he going to be directing for Warner? I mean, that's something that I don't think we've found out yet, how sort of he'll be able to take director for hire jobs across Hollywood, and that's been something that's frustrated his studio partners in the past.
Right. When the Bad Robot deal was at Paramount, I think there was a lot of frustration there because he all of a sudden was taking a director job at Disney doing Star Wars movies. And they're like, wait a second, we're paying you all these millions of dollars for you to direct Star Wars movies for a rival? I think that is something that will be interesting to see when the details of this deal come leaking out, is whether J.J. Abrams can freelance, essentially.
Right.
I doubt it. If I am John Stankey and I'm looking at this in a pragmatic way, I'm saying, great, name your price, but we get everything.
I was trying to think of franchises at Warner Brothers that could use a little J.J. Abrams magic touch. Green Lantern was something that came to mind.
Or Superman. That might be a nice J.J. Abrams vehicle. Thank you, Brooks.
I'm happy to be here.
That's reporter Brooks Barnes. He covers Hollywood for the New York Times.
Grey's Anatomy recently wrapped its 15th, yes, 15th season on ABC. The medical drama created by Shonda Rhimes way back in 2005 is still the number one drama on the network. And no surprise, it's just been renewed for 2 more seasons. Even after more than 300 episodes, some hours of Grey's still have a way of breaking through, which was what happened earlier this year with an episode called Silent All These Years. It featured an unflinching portrayal of a patient undergoing a rape kit examination. Later, as that same patient is transferred to surgery, Joe, played by Camilla Luddington, asks a favor of the women of Grey Sloan Memorial.
Dr. Krev asked us to all stand here. Do we know why?
Just that a patient needs us. She needs all of us.
Okay.
The idea of women lining a hallway in support of a rape victim is one that came to Grey's Anatomy writer Elizabeth Finch several years ago. She'd been on a trip to the UCLA Rape Crisis Center, sponsored by the Writers Guild. She'd been trying with no avail to work that idea into an episode for years, but it wasn't until this season that showrunner Krista Vernoff saw an opportunity. Vernoff and Finch recently sat down with the Hollywood Reporter's Leslie Goldberg to talk about that episode and reflect on their time with Grey's Anatomy. Krista Vernoff actually began working on the show at the very beginning when she saw a script for the pilot.
It was called Surgeons, actually, the draft that I read. And I called my agent and I said, I need to meet this Shonda Rhimes. And he said, you know, that pilot has no heat. It's Patrick Dempsey. He's a pilot killer. And I was like, no, I need to meet her anyway. And so I met with Shonda and we talked about American Idol for 45 minutes, Kelly versus Tamira. And then she hired me.
And this is when Shonda was, no one had heard of her. She had done... Nothing.
She had done the Britney Spears movie.
Crossroads.
Crossroads. And she had done Introducing Dorothy Dandridge. But yeah, no, we didn't know who she was. And we just liked each other. And she very quickly recognized that I could write in her voice, which is key to succeeding on someone else's show. So I was quickly promoted and stayed for 7 years. And then it was like, 7 years, I got to go do something else.
And you left when Grey's had become very quickly in season one, a cultural phenomenon.
Yes, it was a cultural phenomenon from go and was still one when I left. And it wasn't even that I was tired of writing Grey's. I was tired of 24 episodes. I had a 3-year-old. I'd been through a divorce. I wanted to take my kid to school sometimes. I was just tired. And I wanted to try to do my own thing. And so I went and then I did all those things. And I worked for John Wells for 5 years on Shameless. And I wrote a lot of pilots and I made a lot of pilots. And for a variety of complicated Hollywood reasons, they didn't go. And then Shonda called and said, do you want to have lunch? And we had lunch once or twice a year, all those years. And so I didn't think all that much of it, except for that the next email said, hypothetically, when is your deal up?
And I was like, your deal was for Shameless.
My deal was at Warner Brothers. Yeah. And I was working on Shameless. And so we had lunch and she said, do you want the key to the candy store that is Grey's Anatomy? And that was exciting. What I had been her head writer, basically, for the first 7 years. And this was, do you want to take over and run the show? And the opportunity to edit and to place music and to do all those pieces of the job that I had only been able to do on my pilots that I love that didn't go, that was really exciting. The opportunity to take something and run with it.
And this is, of course, after Shonda went to Netflix and needed someone that she could trust. So she dialed up an old friend.
Yes, I think that's what was secretly true. But what she said to me was, you know, I'm tired and you're who I trust to take the show. And that was such
that's
a compliment.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Elizabeth?
I interviewed to be Shonda's assistant for as to be yet titled or shot pilot that became Grey's Anatomy. It was between me and the other guy, and the other guy got the job. And then I walked out of the office being grumbly and being like, whatever, it's not going to be a show. I'm never going to watch it. And all bitter and young and whatever. And then I went off onto other television shows and Grey's kept going. And it became my favorite show, despite my tiny bitterness that I didn't get that job. And I watched it. I watched it obsessively. And thankfully, it was on long enough that when it was time for me to move shows from, I'd been on a bunch of vampire, been on True Blood and Vampire Diaries and had I was done with vampires and wanted to move into more human drama. And I got to work on Grey's and I've been there since season 11.
And that kind of brings us now to season 15. The episode that we're talking about is such a massive one. It's called Silent All These Years. Elizabeth, you wrote it. The idea for this episode, which explores consent in a very, very powerful way that really hasn't been seen on television up until this point. Can you talk about the origins for this episode? It started with, as I recall, the Christine Blasey Ford testimony.
Yeah, we arc the season in the very beginning. But I was directing episode 7, and that is when Dr. Blasey Ford gave her testimony, and all the pundits on all the news channels couldn't quite fully dismiss her the way we like to do with women in our culture because she was so persuasive. So they began to simply question her memory. And, you know, I believe that something happened to her. I'm just not sure she remembers which one of those boys tried to rape her, was sort of the conversation, with a lot of people nodding as if that was a valid assessment. And I turned to Finchie and I said, we have to do something. We have to say something about consent. And it's the only time that I can think of that I've been involved with Grey's Anatomy where an episode was born from sort of an issue that was presently pressing. I know historically we start with character conversations, and sometimes issues come into the show from those conversations. But this time it started with a desire to say something. So I turned to Elizabeth Finch and I said, I heard that some years ago you were pitching an army of awesome. I had heard some of the writers talking about that Finchie'd had this idea of a hallway lined with women supporting a rape survivor and that it had never quite made it to the show. And I said, tell me about the army of awesome.
I work in photographs when I think of shows, when I think of 5 or 6 images, and then I usually try and figure out how they're strung together, and most of the time I have no control over what those images are. But when I went to the UCLA Rape Crisis Center that was sponsored through the WGA, they took us from room to room as if we were a patient in their care. And every place that we went to, there was radio communique in between all the staff to let us know when it was okay for us to go from room to room. And I asked them why, and they said it was because they were protecting one of the patients there who didn't want to see anyone's face. And I was fascinated by how much care they took to cater their facility to the individual, because everyone needs something different in that time and space and crisis. And I thought, wouldn't the opposite also be interesting? Wouldn't it be interesting if instead of having the absence of no one is to let someone know that they weren't alone and make them feel safe and protected? So I saw this line and hallway of women in my head, and it stuck with me for years when we were pitching it before Krista got there. And when this Blasey Ford hearings were happening, when everything was starting to boil up, I started seeing that hallway again, and it just kept haunting me.
So I turned to Elizabeth Finch and I said, go write this. And we had conversations for several weeks. First, she stuttered and she said, really? Really? Because she had been told no by the previous showrunners, who are very progressive feminist human beings. They were struggling to find the conflict in the story that she was pitching. Rape is almost always a story told by men, heroic men, doctors. You know, we even did a rape story early on Grey's Anatomy where the survivor was asleep the whole time and it was Derek's story. We do cops, vindictive husbands. But the idea of a story of a woman who's been through this, having to now survive the further violations of rape kit and surgery, that anybody thought that there wasn't enough conflict in that speaks to our culture.
In addition to the hallway of women, was the fact that there was a 2-minute long scene where a rape kit is administered.
You say yes, we go to the next step. You say no, at any time, we stop.
What was the fight to get that on air?
You know, every time we put out a script, you get ABC Broadcast Standards and Practices notes. And so we got some notes on the rape kit scene that were standard. You know, please don't show sexual fluids on the Q-tips. Please don't show sexual fluids under the black light. And as we often do, we push back against that note. But at that time, Finchie and I sort of looked at each other and we were like, we know this needs to be fought. We are too tired. We were shooting multiple episodes. Silent All These Years was a standalone, which means anyway, we called Shonda. And Shonda wrote a really persuasive note to ABC saying, listen, you air actual rape. You air the actual violence. You don't have a problem with the violence. This is the medicine. And we need to be able to show it in full. So respectfully, we declined this note. And what was really amazing about that is that ABC came back and said, oh, you're right, to the point where one of the people in that broadcast standards department came and stood in the hallway. They recognized that truth and came and participated.
And we'll get into that scene in a minute, but the standards and practices, can you contextualize what that is? I mean, you've been in this industry for a very long time. How often does broadcast standards and practices flip like that?
Rarely. There's usually a much bigger fight. If you're really fighting something, it's rare that they come back and go, you're right.
And there's concessions, you know, we give a little bit, they give a little
yes.
bit.
Yeah, it's, yes.
And this came concession free.
It really was like, you're right, do what you need to do. Your scene.
It aired as written.
Coming up after a short break, Grey's Anatomy showrunner Krista Vernoff tells us about convincing writer Elizabeth Finch to appear on screen in a powerful scene she'd been pitching for years. There may have been some light bullying involved. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters. We're listening to Leslie Goldberg of The Hollywood Reporter talking to Grey's Anatomy showrunner Krista Vernoff and writer-producer Elizabeth Finch. They're talking about a recent episode called Silent All These Years. It's an intense 44 minutes of television that tackles topics including rape, abortion, and sexual consent. One of the most affecting moments comes when Dr. Joe Karev, played by Camilla Luddington, transports Abby, a rape victim, played by Kalila Joy, to surgery.
Are you ready? Yes.
In a show of support and solidarity, dozens of women staffers line the hallway as Joe pushes Abby's gurney toward the elevators that'll take her to the OR. Among those women in the hallway are some faces long familiar to the show, like Chandra Wilson's Dr. Bailey and Dr. Meredith Grey herself, played by Ellen Pompeo. But there are others that even eagle-eyed fans may not recognize. As writer Elizabeth Finch explained, there's a reason for that.
As soon as the table read happened, it was like a snowball effect. People were kind of sidling up to everyone and asking, hey, I don't know what you're planning to do for the hallway, but I'd really like to be a part of it. People in wardrobe and makeup, and people were just starting to ask. And then we realized everyone was asking another member, that they all felt like they wanted to stand there and bear witness and hold that space. And they were all willing to take a pay cut. They were willing to take off the afternoon, take off the day, do whatever they wanted to do. And because we live in the world of Amazing Shondaland, they made it possible so that they didn't have to take any time off, so that they could be there and stand there and say everything. They brought a bunch of men in to help and do their jobs for those couple of hours that it took to shoot it. And it was incredible. Despite my own anxieties about being in it, the experience of itself was amazing.
Yeah, we bullied Finchy into doing it. She didn't want to do it, and there was a lot of pressure. She tried to say, no, I have to watch the monitors. I have to produce it. And I said, I'll watch the monitors. I'll produce it. And we sent her to hair and makeup and made her be on camera. And but everyone else wanted to do it. And listen, we work in Hollywood. Money is the bottom line. The fact that there was no resistance to, yep, we'll pay a little extra money so that everyone can participate, the understanding of what we were doing here and how badly needed it was felt throughout. And it's pretty amazing what they did.
Yeah. And as you work on this episode, RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, was involved. Can you talk a little bit about what input they had?
The initial research was done at the Rape Crisis Center in UCLA, and that I still had all of my notes and all that. So in building the story, I stayed very close to those notes and that research. When it came time to actually writing the script and looking at the language, we had RAIN vet the script to see if there was any language we should adjust, if there was anything that we could do to illuminate anything. And their only note was, thank you for including the words "and men," that we included men in the group of survivors, that it wasn't just about women.
And that was the scene where you have one of the doctors on the show, played by Kim Raver, the character of Teddy, who is a former Army doctor, talking to Camilla Luddington's character about a protocol.
I've seen soldiers like this. Young women and young men brutalized with no idea how to talk about it. What you did today with Abby, that was not protocol.
I know, and I'm sorry.
I'm saying... it should be.
That scene was really interesting. It was almost cut so many times for time because the episode came in 19 minutes long. But Finchie kept saying to me, but RAIN said this. And it gives me chills when I say it now. I can't even believe I thought about cutting that scene, but I'm glad that we didn't. We wanted to say there actually are better protocols than the protocols that are practiced in most of our hospitals in this country. The Rape Crisis Center in Santa Monica can teach you what they are. We just put them in this episode. There are better protocols than the ones we're using.
You know, Grey's Anatomy's right now is, in its 15th season, is ABC's most watched drama, TV's longest running primetime medical drama. You guys topped ER in season 15 at the same time that you're exploring incredible subjects like consent. Getting back to the episode, this originally aired in March. I wonder, what kind of feedback have you guys heard from viewers, from people in your own communities about this episode? What kind of impact has this episode had?
It actually started during the shooting of the episode, during production, where I would be there all day long and people would come up to me, particularly men would come up and kind of be shy about it and then start talking to me about their sister, about their mom, about how worried they are about their daughter. They would talk about things that it illuminated that they didn't quite understand before, that now I understand why this still impacts my wife to this day. Then it made it out on air, and that continued of people telling their stories, not just thanks for showing a version of me on TV or thanks for telling a story that's similar to mine, writing really long letters, long messages, and just bearing their souls and telling their stories. There's people saying, I'm going to go call the hotline now and tell somebody something that I've never told anyone before. I think there was a 43 or 47% uptick that night to RAIN.
Wow.
Who called in. They staffed it up extra in anticipation of this episode. But there are people in my life who I've known since I was in high school who said, thank you for saying what I can't, and couldn't say more. But it was someone that I know incredibly well admitting to me that we just showed an experience that she had. And it continues every time we interact with people who have seen the episode. People still share their stories.
Krista and Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was The Hollywood Reporter's Leslie Goldberg speaking to Grey's Anatomy showrunner Krista Vernoff and writer Elizabeth Finch. The 15th season of Grey's Anatomy, including the episode Silent All These Years, is now available on Netflix. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith and Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW shows at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Matt Holzman, filling in for Kim Masters, and we'll see you next week on The Business.